This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3083 for Wednesday, the 27th of May 2020. Today's show is entitled Mumbling While on Lockdown. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 50 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, two Edinburgh-based hosts have a chat from their respective houses.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Hacker Public Radio. This is Dave Morris, and I'm talking to Mr. X. Hi, Mr. X. How are you doing?
Hi, Dave. Doing fine in these interesting times we're living in.
Indeed. So we're just doing the thing that I think more and more people are doing, which is just getting together over Mumble or other methods just to have a chat, you know, because sitting in your house without much chance of talking to anybody is a bit frustrating. So it's quite nice to virtually get out and have a wee chat. So that's what we're doing.
Yes, indeed. Of course, obviously been sort of video chatting and whatnot with other members of the family and whatnot, my mother's becoming very au fait with hangouts and whatnot, and my brother's been using Duo, so which seems to be a bit of a kind of mess that Google's done with their video conferencing. They've got the Duo, which kind of replaced Hangouts, but it doesn't do text chat. You know, you can't do text, you can only do video, and I didn't really know anything about Duo. It's my brother that was telling me, like, he's an IT, so it just seems a bit of a mess, really.
I don't know anything about it at all, actually. I was telling you earlier that I had a wee chat with a friend using Jitsi during the week. We just used the Jitsi Meet thing, which is a web-based thing, so you just go to it and start up a chat, and it gives you a name. Oh, I think you can probably give it your own name, and then you share it with your friends or whoever you're speaking to. And I think there's passwords involved, or can be, but we didn't bother with that. So that seemed to work quite well, and it does have a text stream as well. So you can, when I was having problems with my microphone, we were able to say, "Dave, are you there? Can you hear me?" And all that sort of stuff over the text, which is quite cool.
Yeah, it's fine. We were just having a brief chat before we hit the record button, and I have a webcam, or I did have a webcam many years ago, and I gave it to my mother, and I don't think she ever used it. So, you know, next time I see her from a distance, at a socially acceptable distance, I'll ask her if she can place it somewhere between us, and then I can pick it up and...
Yeah, that would be quite good. I should say, by the way, just as a digression, I'm sitting in my back room of my house, my sort of back kitchen, dining room area, with the back door open because it's really nice weather, and my neighbour's kids are out rampaging around, so you will hear noises off, but it's all part of the ambience, I think.
Yes, well, I'm sitting in the spare room, stroke hobby room, stroke video room, and it's cooking. I'm sure I'll manage that.
Yeah. It's just I forget sometimes because I've done recordings like this in the past, and then I listen to them and think, oh, it's birdsong on it. You know, there's some twittering bird outside in the back garden, or a crow or something shouting, and you think, oh, I wonder how that comes across to people at the other end.
Yeah, indeed. Well, actually, I had another day, I was down in the garden at the back of the garden. It's not a particular garden, and I had the tablet with me, and I gave my mother a call, and it was really weird because, well, I had to turn the brightness fairly high up on the screen, obviously, but it was fine, and of course she could see all the greenery in the garden and whatnot, and I was surprised, the Wi-Fi signal held up really nice, and we found our internet connection's been good and solid so far, so which of course all these people online it might be an issue, but no, we've been doing all right, you know.
Yeah, I can't complain either. It's been pretty good. I'm actually on an Ethernet connection because I've got a lot of wiring in my house, so I like to use that over the rather than the Wi-Fi for a lot of things. But that's just me. My kids would not bother at all if they were here. They don't use it, even though I've actually got an 8-port network switch on the kitchen table here, so sometimes when they come to visit for dinner or something, the laptops and tablets and things come out and they say, "Dad, is there a port I could use on that?" And they plug in, and so it's a new fitting on the dining room table these days, which is, I don't know if that's ultra geeky or just realistic.
Yeah, there can't be many people that have a multi-port switch and their hub on their dining room table.
It works, though. It works. Well, you see, my daughter, I'm not seeing them much. They don't live with me at the moment, but they do come in for a quick visit every so often, you know. And we sit the requisite distance apart. And but my daughter earlier on this year was doing a lot of study, and she used to like to come over here and use this big kitchen table for stuff, and she'd say, "Oh, can I just plug my laptop in, you know, to get a better signal than on the Wi-Fi?" But it's a fairly rare thing. I think it's just sort of getting access to weird systems and stuff, or maybe the university's system that she's using or something like that. But so it seemed like the right thing to do, though. Maybe the time will come when there won't be an 8-port switch on the table here, but we'll see.
I used to have an old BT router, and it was hacked, not by myself, but obviously it was originally locked down to BT, and I had a very limited number of ports in the back, so I got myself a cheap switch, and I used that for a while. So I did have something like that here, but I now have another router which has got a few more ports in it, and I don't actually have as many ports as I used to have, because with the switch I had more. But I can just about squeeze into the four ports on the back, and I use Wi-Fi for the other bits and pieces. But I'll tell you a thing I noticed was when I got this tablet, I discovered, obviously, Wi-Fi's, I think I've already touched this before, but obviously the Wi-Fi standards have gone up and up and up, and my Nexus 7 was okay, but I've discovered that my Wi-Fi speed across the network, because just transferring from machine to machine, it's way faster than the Ethernet, so it's such a surprising.
Yeah, well, yes, you're right. I've actually got two routers in the house. I probably mentioned this before, but I had one that my ISP said was failing. You know, the wide area network side was failing, which happens. I don't disbelieve them, but of course the rest of it was working, so I've actually transferred it through to the back of the house, and I'm just using it as a bridge system. So it's got network ports on it, but it's also got a whole load more wireless connections. So maybe that's why my kids tend to not to be asking for direct connections so much these days, because the wireless is better. But I see that nowadays a lot of, if you go and buy some of the more upmarket routers, they come as a sort of cluster of machines in some cases. I've not really got into this. I'm sure other people will know a lot more about this than I do. But I see some, like the Google are selling routers, and they come as a sort of a cluster which you put all over the house, and they network between each other and make a sort of matrix, or whatever you'd call it, a mesh, I think, a mesh networking between them. So, you know, obviously dealing with the instance where your reception is good here but not so good there because of the walls in the way or whatever, which is interesting. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. I do know people who have had issues with the Wi-Fi and whatnot, maybe because the house isn't so big, and I don't know, but I was, as I said, I was at the bottom of the garden and I had a video conference and it was working fine as well. So I don't really need any extenders, but I think it's maybe more to do with the fact that the size of the house rather than anything else, you know. And I think the walls are not, they're not like solid stone or anything like that. So which obviously absorbs the microwave and whatnot. So yeah, Wi-Fi is okay, you know, for me anyway.
Yeah, my work in IT at the university down the road from here, getting Wi-Fi around that place was a nightmare because a lot of the buildings are steel framed things. You know, when they're built, they build a girder structure and then they do sort of glass fill or, you know, concrete panels or something in between them. And so to get reception, wireless reception through them was a total nightmare. Not a thing I was involved with, but hearing the guys had to do that swearing about it, it was, yeah. And the building we were in had like a sort of corrugated iron skin on the outside. It was not corrugated iron, but it was a sort of metallic skin on the outside of the building because it was trendy and architects thought it was good. And of course that led to all sorts of problems as well. Couldn't get a phone signal in the place. You have to go out to use your phone. So all sorts of clever things like that.
Wow, that's awkward. Yeah. I've got it's just a standard router that came with ISP, and it got slated, the router when it came out, and just recently I got an alternative. Still, if you sign up for another so many months, we'll make it cheaper and you'll get a new router. So I got that anyway, but I thought I don't want a new router, but happy the one I've got, just give me the cheaper contract. But no, I end up with my new router, which I haven't even taken out of the box, so I'm quite happy with this one. It's all set up and I can't be bothered reconfiguring a new router, so I've just left it as working fine. So
yeah, it's they seem to be fairly disposable, these things, don't they? My daughter had a, when she was away at university, living in a flat with some friends and stuff, they got a TalkTalk contract and it came with a router. And then at the end of the contract, when they left, said, well, do you want your router back? They said, oh, no, you can have it. So it's in this house somewhere. I'm still not quite sure what to do with it. It's probably something you could do with it. It's probably hackable, but it's too many things to play with here, so I haven't done anything with it.
Yeah, and that's a couple of these sort of things, like the BT router. This one, that one will be locked to TalkTalk, so, or GIFGAF, or whatever. TalkTalk's like all mixed up. That's right. So you won't be able to use it unless you hack it, as you say. So,
There's all sorts of hacks that you can come across. I've not looking for that particular one, but other ones I've seen where people show that if you bridge these two points on the circuit board, then you can do a factory reset on it, and then you're at liberty to do whatever you like, even put new firmware on some of them. So you know, some of the ones that are compatible with OpenWRT and that type of thing, which is fewer than it used to be, but you know, you can do it.
Oh yeah, it's OpenWRT. I looked into that because I had myself one of these slugs. I didn't actually end up doing anything with it, but remember the open.
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah, the slug thing.
Yeah. I don't remember what his proper name was, but I've known a number of people have these over the years, and they were quite a thing at one time. A bit slow now, I think.
Yeah, well, that's it. I never really got anywhere with it. I had great plans for doing something with it, but I never did, so it was a waste of time, really.
Yeah. I in the early days of household computing and stuff, I bought myself, way before the Raspberry Pi era, I bought myself one of these plug computer things, which was, what was it called? Oh, a Shiva plug. So that's just a little ARM processor in a box. It wasn't actually part of the plug, though some of them were. It was a separate box on the end of a cable, but it ran Debian, and I used to use it quite a lot actually for a while. It's pretty weedy, especially when the Raspberry Pi started to come out. It looked quite feeble, but I still got it. And I was thinking the other day, I wonder if I could actually put something useful on there and get it back to life again. So it's not actually dead, but it'll have a very, very, very old Linux version on it, and think a lot of the support for these things has gone, but it'd be quite nice to resurrect it, just so I can say, you know, it's still usable.
Yeah, I remember the Shiba plug things and looking in envy, thinking, oh, I should have bought that rather than the slug thing, because I think it came out a wee bit after the slug. And it did look a bit more fun, and there was a bit more you could do with it. So, I thought, well, I remember it's typical Canny Scott. I bought this thing. I'm not going to buy another one.
No, yeah, it's probably very wise. I changed my attitude once the Raspberry Pi came out and started to buy them whenever the mood took me, because they're so relatively cheap, especially the Zero is for about a fiver or whatever it was in the first instance. Amazing. So yeah, I have a few of those knocking around the house.
Yeah, I never bought a Pi Zero. I never got around to that, and it's so cheap, but I've got three or four Pis around the house, and I think, is it a Pi 3 is the most recent one I have. I haven't got the 4. They're very, very useful. Great, great devices, you know.
Absolutely. The Pi 4 is a bit of a mixed blessing still, I think. It's with all the heat issues and the fact that you can't boot them off a USB device, which is what I'd been doing, that's the way my Pi 3 is set up. Just got the 1.3, I can't remember now. So I got SSDs and plugged them into these various machines, and it was great to be able to put the entire operating system on the SSD and then boot it from there without the need for an SD card at all, you know. That was entirely possible, but it's not possible with 4 at the moment.
You've dropped out there, Dave.
Oh, you hear me?
Yes. You said it was great to be able to put the entire, and then you dropped out at that moment.
All right, that's very strange. Can you hear me still?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Maybe my finger slipped off the push to talk button or something. No, just to say that being able to boot off the SSD without needing an SD card at all, I thought was quite good. You can just do the boot off the SD card on the Pi 4 and then do the rest off the of an SSD, but I haven't got around to setting that up yet. But why they didn't make that available from day one, I don't know.
Yeah, I've never tried any of that. I've always been perfectly happy with the SD card. It's funny, people have complained. I've had people complain about trashing SD cards in their Pi, and also about the sound as well. And it's funny that the SD card, I've never had a single SD card fail on any of my Pis. I think I've probably still got the original SD card that I had in my very, very first Pi kicking about here somewhere. And I've got a Pi 3 which runs every single day non-stop, and it's never crashed. And I've upgraded the card a couple of times, and the audio as well, you know, okay, it was a little bit clicky and poppy in the early days, and it used a lot of processing. If you checked it, you know, at top or whatever, you'd see it using quite a bit of the processing. But now there's so much firmware hacking going on by the Pi Institute, you know, that it uses hardly any processing, and I think the audio sounds great. I mean, I use it on my Corus headphones, and certainly more than good enough for voice, and probably even good enough for music as well, I would argue, you know?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you're right, it has come on a lot, hasn't it? And a lot of clever add-ons, hardware add-ons for the Pis have improved things a lot. There's some very fancy audio add-ons, I see. Quite expensive ones in some cases that you can put on. So yeah, a lot of possibilities. Sticking with the Pi, regardless, I guess is the way. I have had one SD card fail. I think it did. My original Pi, the first generation one, the Model A or whatever it was called. Is that what it was called? I've forgotten. It's just here on the shelf beside me. But I was using that for a while as a cups driver for my old inkjet printer. I say laser jet, no, it's just an inkjet. I did an HBR show about it, but it failed eventually, the Pi, and I think it was the card, though I've not actually investigated. It's here because I was going to try and resurrect it with a new card and put one of these very minimal versions of something on it, Claudio Miranda did a show recently where he was talking about, I think it was Tiny Core that he put on one of these. So I was going to give that a shot, see if it was, that was usable at all.
Yeah, Tiny Core. I've had a wee play of that many, many years ago. That was fun and quite amazing wee distro. And I was speaking to you, I think, last time and trying to work out this small, minimal distro I'd been playing with before. It was Puppy Linux. That was the one. I couldn't remember the name of it. Puppy Linux.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had that on
Is that still going?
I don't think so. No, I think it's moved on. Somebody was talking about that on a podcast recently. I don't remember the details. I think it's changed name and it's been sort of subsumed into something else, I believe, but I don't know the details.
Yeah, I have a funny feeling that they're not bark when you boot it up or something like that. Something like that.
I think I ran it because did it not come with a bunch of useful tools for investigating disks and that type of stuff? So you could use that as a means of looking over a possibly dead disk from another system.
Yeah, possibly.
Am I confusing it with something else?
Maybe I'm getting confused with Puppy. I did definitely try Puppy Linux. Remember, was it Damn Small Linux? Was that another one I tried? I can't remember. There was a few I did try. There was one I was using on a machine which wasn't mine. It was just a way to get a Linux prompt to experiment, sort of thing. And I can't remember whether it was Damn Small Linux or Puppy Linux or one of these ones anyway. But I can't remember very much about it. I was really just interested in getting a bash prompt rather than anything else, you know.
Yes, oh, absolutely, absolutely. No, I think I just played around with these things, didn't use them in earnest to any great degree. But I do recall, maybe it was an old laptop or something else I ran it on. I really can't remember. I still got my daughter's old laptop, which is pretty weedy now. I'm just trying to think what to put on that. So, trouble is, though, if you go and resurrect old machines, then there's not always a good use for them. And with the Raspberry Pis, they're not using up much power. Whereas, you know, you use an old desktop or an old laptop, then you can potentially have this thing running a longish time and then using up quite a lot of electricity. And it just goes against the grain a bit.
Yeah, that's right. You were talking about the, what's it now? Oh, it was a print server using CUPS, that was it. Yeah, I did that for a while as well on my old compact server, and I was planning on using my Raspberry Pi to take over from that, but it never happened. And I just thought, I'd kind of moved it close to the PC anyway, so that I'll just plug this USB plug in and that'll fix it. It's just too lazy.
Yeah. No, it was just one of those challenges I set myself, and I was really happy when I actually managed to solve it. In fact, it's one of those printers with a scanner in it. And I think within the past couple of months, maybe a bit longer now, my daughter came in saying, "Dad, I've got this thing, can you scan it?" And I was thinking, oh wow, and yes, the answer was yes, I could scan it from my desktop machine through in the other room. It's in the front of the house, the printer, and I was able to grab the scan off it still, you know. I was quite surprised that I put a different Pi on it to act as the CUP server, a newer Pi, it did work. But, you know, it's just once a year you get asked to do things like that, I find. And it's not, I very, very rarely scan stuff myself.
Yeah, I've got a bog standard sort of an old Canon scanner, which is compatible with Linux, so that works fine. Canon scanner, I think it is. But it's funny, when I had my network printer set up through CUPS on my server, the printer could print onto DVDs and CDs, you remember, and that was all the rage.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a dedicated CD-DVD printing application that came with a printer, or maybe I bought it, I can't remember. And of course, that only ran on Windows, of course. I think it was maybe Windows XP or something like that. And I had my, and of course, I didn't really what I mean, I tend to use, I still the same tend to use Linux when I can, and I very rarely use Windows. But I had this app, and of course there's a option to print to a network printer, and it's not the standard Windows network printer. It's well, you'll know more. I can't really remember an awful lot about CUPS now, but I was actually able to get Windows to talk to this CUPS server, and it would actually spit out a disk. Now I got an error at the end of it. Oh, there's a critical error. It didn't work. And then out came the disk at the other side. I thought, oh, that's worked perfectly. So I was amazed. I could print something in XP through CUPS on my server at the side of the room, sort of thing.
CUPS is actually pretty good. We did a lot of work with that at work. You know, we used it a lot, is what I mean, because in the various days when PCs appeared, getting stuff printed off PCs was a real pain, and there were various, there was things like LPR, and there was a thing called LPRNG, what's it called, LPR Next Generation, and then CUPS, as I recall, that let you do some quite smart things. We had a photocopier. There was a big photocopier which I think it was mainly used by the department to produce documentation and stuff. It's a huge great thing. I discovered it was on the network. It'd been put on the network, and I discovered that it was actually just a printer. You could print it, so you could do double-sided A3 with it, and I think you could also print stuff, and it had a binding capability, and no idea why we had this sort of printing and binding capability in the department, but we did. I seem to be the only one who used most of it at one time. So great stuff.
Yeah, very good. I've got, because Clatty did an episode, one of the great episodes, because he became a bit of a CUPS expert. So I know what he was saying, something about how he sort of stumbled across the bit behind, you know, the CUPS server, and you know, you look at it through a web client. I seem to remember you pop your address in the bar at the top, and then you get right into CUPS sort of thing, and it's like, oh, this is like, it's a new world sort of thing. Yeah.
Oh, it's got a lot of features. It's really quite cool. And a lot of these network printers and stuff also have quite sophisticated interfaces that you can access through web servers in my fairly limited experience. So, but yes, the whole business of printing on fancy stationery and stuff is quite fun. At the university I worked at, there was a point at which our line printers on a mainframe we used to generate the student matriculation cards, and they had special stationery which had you know, a sheet of paper with a card stuck to it, and the printer would have to go and print their name and, you know, matriculation number and all that sort of stuff on this card, and then spit it out, and then somebody took the card off the sheet of paper and handed it to the student, because they all got pre-printed before the students arrived. And so I was a little bit involved in that and setting it up and so forth. It is enormous fun. Universities are strange like that, because you can, there's a certain element of messing about, or you know, having a bit more leisure to get a thing to work. Or that was the case back in the 80s and 90s and stuff, less so now. But a lot of fun in that area.
Yeah, it's funny. I think everybody, I don't know whether it's an age thing, you know, whether, you know, you just remember things with rose-tinted glasses and stuff. But I hear this over and over again, that, you know, you had more time to sort of do things in the past, and things seem more satisfying, you know, you get hands-on, and there's less and less of that now. It's just, everything's just sitting in front of a computer, and we used to do big print jobs. We'd get with, it was like folded dot matrix, you know, these kind of, what do you call it? It's the folded sheets, they go, you know, left, right, and a big pile, basically. And this thing would go back and forward, and come out the end, and you would tear bits off. So you'd do big print runs, sort of thing, of of computer program listings and whatnot. So yeah, that was.
That was pretty much the stuff I was involved with when I first started working in IT. Fanfold, 132 column line printer paper stuff, the sort that you would get, and it had alternate green and white bars on it or something like that.
That's right, Fanfold. I couldn't think of the word. That's exactly it, yes.
It's got sprocket holes down the side and all that sort of good stuff.
We also worked with these great big Diablo discs. These are huge big things. They're like a big giant pizza, that's what it looked like, a pizza box. And you pull the front face down on the divide and on the drive. I mean, it was the size of a coffee table, and it would hold, I think it held a massive 5 megabytes of data. And so you slid it into the front of the machine, and you lifted it was almost like a bit like a big, I don't know, oven or almost like a toaster or something. So you pull the thing down, and you would slide the big drive into it, and then push it back up again, and you'd flick a switch from load to run, and it would slowly build up and build up and build up, and you'd hear a big clunk, and a big red flag would pop up to show that the head had engaged. And yeah, 5 megabytes that held.
Yeah, I do remember those times very well. Yeah. We, I probably told the story before, but in 1987, I remember the year very, very clearly, because at the university I was at, because it was in the days when universities used to get funded centrally for their computer facilities, and they got mainframes and stuff. We finished the 7 years that we were funded for our mainframe at the time, and we were allowed by government, this is a government body that had all that money, to buy a new machine for the students and staff. And we ended up spending about 1.1 million, which is a lot in 1987, on a couple of deck faxes. Yeah, 1.1 million it was. It filled a big room, two massive big machines. Networking would handle something like 200 and odd simultaneous connections from terminals, of course, but we had all this array of big machines with disks in them. So there was like a stack of disks, one on top of the other, and they stood almost as high as sort of fridge freezer does these days, you know, the sort of big almost walk-in fridge freezers you see nowadays, each one of these, and they had like three disks in them. And the total disk capacity for this 1.1 million quid's worth of machine was 1 gigabyte for an entire university.
Wow. People just can't comprehend how things work. You know, if you're of a certain age, you just wouldn't comprehend that. You know, I think, I'm sure the first company PC in the office, I think, was it something like £100,000, something like that? I can't remember. It was something crazy like that for one PC or something like this. It was just, yeah, things were just so expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
Even a dot matrix printer would be prohibitively expensive for the everyday person, you know?
Yeah. It was all, they were so rare, weren't they? I guess that was part of why the prices were so high. They didn't become commodities at that point, but there's also a massive markup on it, I suspect, because the machine that we got rid of in 1987, it was a Burroughs mainframe, Burroughs being a company that's long gone now, but a great chunk of a thing. And I think two guys arrived in, because we sold it for scrap. Two guys arrived in sort of low loader thingies and forklifted it, the bits of it, into the back of it. And you can see the suspension on these things sort of way down at the bottom. No way they wanted to go over any significant bumps. But the story was that those were going to be sold into Africa, where they'd probably be put back into use again. You know, it was a very, very different world then.
Yeah. I mean, I think we tended to have, equipment that was, you know, old hat, probably even when I joined, because we were using punch card machines. They were amazing because they were like, it's like a big Hoover, you know, you would power it up, pull the hopper back, and you'd have your stack of cards, which you were very careful not to drop, because if you did, you'd have a hell of a job getting them back in the right order again. So, yeah, so put them in the hopper, you push the button, and it would build up, and for all the world, that seemed like a great big Hoover. And you'd get a giant sucking noise, and just fly through this machine, or often not, and just jam halfway through. And that was to boot the machine up, you know, the computer up.
I see those sorts of things. Yeah, the Burroughs machine that we had before had a lot of it was punch cards. And as a student, I had used to get a thing that looked like a small suitcase, which was the width of a 80 column punch card, and you put your card deck in there, and then it was sort of locked down, they locked the lid down, and there's a handle you could trot around it, because woe betide you if you ever drop that lot. As you say, finding, putting them all back together in order would be a nightmare, even though in those days there was a machine that would put sequence numbers on them, on the columns from whatever it was, 72 onwards or something. They put a sequence number, and you could actually take that deck to a collator and get them sorted according to that number. But you'd need to have been really careful about putting anything you added to that card deck. You would have to make sure that you put numbers on it, on the cards, which interleaved in the right place with the cards that were already there, you know. So yeah, had a little bit of experience. I never dropped one though.
Well, we never had anything as fancy as that. You know, we were the collators. If we dropped it, we had to fix it. And then I've seen great big piles up in the desk, you know, a few feet high sort of thing. But I've seen people carrying big piles of them. And you'd strap rubber bands around it. That's how we kind of kept them together, with a big rubber band.
Yeah. I've seen that as well. I once saw that, this was at Manchester University when I was a student there. I saw a guy come from the computer department with his punch cards and a big pile of printout on the top of it. You know, something which must have been 6-8 inches thick or something like that, maybe even more. And he had that balanced on top of his cards, and he walked around the corner and he didn't have anything on the top of the printout. Just wet down, and it was a windy day. and in between the buildings of the university used to get some incredible, you know, winds and little mini tornadoes and stuff, and his entire stack of printout just got sucked up into the air by a sort of mini tornado and disappeared. It was tragic. I think it was completely wrecked because it was sort of mashed up and sent all over the place. So yeah, yes, those are the days.
Oh, crikey, that's something else. You're talking about suitcases, but just reminding me, these Diablo discs, as I say, they were. I mean, if imagine the size of the seating, the seat cushion of the seating portion of a normal office seat, and it was probably that diameter, maybe even more than that, in fact, a hard case thing, maybe an inch deep, something like that. And I remember that our clerk in the office, and he was given this fancy device. It was a big sort of aluminium clad suitcase, and it looked like something out of either a Mission Impossible thing or something, maybe James Bond, or maybe Joe 90 or something like that. People of a certain age will know all these sort of things. It was a silver chrome thing, rounded and chromed, and really, really expensive. What's going to be inside this thing? It's amazing. You know, it looks so high tech, and you opened it up, and it was almost like a record deck thing, and you basically placed the Diablo disc on this device. And it had various attachments that you clipped on in various places, and it opened there's a kind of slice that would open so the head could get in, and then there was like vernier calipers that laid on top of the disc surface, and it, you could rotate the disc and look for wobble, you know, as a disc buckled by more than X percentage. If it is, then it will be failed, and all this stuff to check the integrity of the disc, sort of thing, you know.
It would crash the heads if the disc was too wobbly, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly it, you know. So the whole host of you checked the actual outer edge to make sure it wasn't moving in and out, basically, and also up and down as well, and various other tests that you did on the thing, you know, and there was counters and all sorts of things. But I thought it just looked so high tech. I think it came from America. Typical, obviously Americans make things look very flashy and look, you know, like something out of a movie sort of thing. I'm just impressed with it, the way it looked, basically.
Yeah. Some of the technology back in those days did look very, very impressive, didn't it? Yeah. Something I was seeing recently, I can't remember where I saw it, on the web somewhere perhaps, there was some excitement over the ability back in the day to visualize the contents of magnetic tape, I think, maybe something like that. I have seen that done. You know, magnetic tape's got sort of recording in, I mean, computer stuff, half inch stuff, did get recorded in chunks with tape marks in between and stuff like that. So there was a liquid you could get, which was very, very, very fine iron filings in some sort of a medium. I don't know what it was, like alcohol or something like that. And you had to put your tape out onto a flat, smooth surface and paint this stuff onto it with a little sort of brush thing. And then it would all align itself according to the magnetic recording on the tape, so you could. The idea was that you could spot in a faulty tape where to cut it or splice it around where the tape marks were, because the tape marks were just sort of clear spots on the tape. So yeah, I remember seeing somebody doing that and then being taught how to do it myself, because I had the job of doing some mag tape restoration or recovery after they'd got wrecked. You know, they got jammed in the machine and stretched, and then you'd cut it at a convenient point and then try and reread from the sort of last good spot on the tape. I'd never seen them spliced, actually, because it would be really hard. They moved so fast. If a splice caught inside the machinery, it would wreck even further, I would imagine. But yeah, it's a lot of seems like incredibly cool stuff. Now it sounds archaic and weird, doesn't it?
Well, it's funny. I know what you're talking about. I saw an episode of, it was a series. It was in the 80s on Channel 4 here in the UK. It was called The Secret Life of Machines, and it was done by, I think, a chap called Tim Hunkin. And he did one on was it in the video recorder? And of course, he took it from the very early stages. Just, you know, how did we first record things? It was about wax cylinders and whatnot, and all the way up to eventually get the video recorder. I just have to decline this just now. Hold on a wee second. And that was my mother trying to call me. She's wondering what's happening. Hope she doesn't try again. Oh no. Anyway, so they eventually got to the bit, you know, magnetic recording, and he swiped stuff onto the surface of the tape to show. He actually recorded blips on a bandsaw, and they had a coil around the bandsaw. The bandsaw went down slowly, and they made the magnetic moving coil lip up and down to show how you recorded it.
That's
really clever.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of clever ideas. And now, what else did he do now? So what he did eventually was to show what a tape is. He took a piece of sellotape, and then he got some iron filings and rubbed it over the sticky bit of the iron filings. And then he looked into the tape mechanism of a tape recorder. I know a reel-to-reel, but it just held both ends, basically. And as he let it slide through his fingers, he said, "This is recorded in sticky tape and rust." And he put it back into the heads and pushed the play button, out it came.
Wow. Yeah. The technology was it was effective, but it was very primitive, wasn't it, I guess?
Yeah, I was listening. Funny, I was listening. I've got one of these. It's funny. I've got one of these Google speaker things, which I got given, and it would have been a thing I would never ever have bought. You know, but it's one of these things. You know, I got given it, and actually I found it useful, so I ended up keeping the thing. And it was talking about, thank you for listening to this, and if you're of a certain age, you might have been listening to it, and said you could have been listening to, and it mentioned tapes and such like, and it mentioned if you're old enough, you might even remember the 8-track. And of course, I looked at Mrs. X and said, do you know what an 8-track is? Can you remember an 8-track? Oh, no, I don't know what that is. So I had to explain what an 8-track was.
Yeah. I think I had a cousin here who had an 8-track player in a car or something. They weren't all that popular over here, as I recall, but they did exist. I have seen them.
Yeah, no, I never had one either. It's probably a little bit before my time, maybe just. But I have seen one in operation. And even more interesting, I think I saw was there's the Museum of Communications, which is over. I don't know. Obviously, for people listening, there's a Museum of Communications over the other side of the. What is it now? It's over the other side of the Fourth Road Bridge. I can't even remember where it is now. But anyway, it's a wee museum. And they've got some really unique pieces of technology. And there's a device that came from Germany, and it uses, it's like a cartridge thing, and it's got a tape and it runs through. But the peculiar thing about it is it isn't based on magnetism. It's actually almost like a record, but in tape form, so that a needle gets pressed onto the tape. And as a tape goes past, it plays a stylus. And I think, depending on where you place the head, you could have a number of recordings, different tracks, which you can just select at will by switching from one groove to the next. It's astonishing. It's just you know, there's no magnet at all. It's grooves on a tape.
Oh, I've never heard of that. That's amazing. I'd like to find out where that is and go and visit it one time. That sounds like a good thing to see.
Yeah, they do a whole host of things, this Museum of Communications. If anyone's in the Edinburgh area, it's only on certain times of the year. They had a mini Strowger exchange, which they have different things in different years. So you don't know what you're going to see. You can go to the website and it's called the Museum of Communications. And let's say one of the years they had a wee mini Strowger exchange, and you know, you could pick up the handset and turn the dial, and you could hear all of the electromechanical things clunking round and raising and dropping and all that sort of stuff. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I do remember them. There was a guy, when I was a student at Manchester University, there was a guy who was controlling a bank of cameras or something using an old remainder Strowger. Because basically you pulsed was it some sort of a motor, or was it a stepper motor, or was it solenoids or something? Because basically you moved an arm around an arc, I think, didn't you? And it made different connections as it went along, something like that. I'd only seen this once or twice, but he built a machine that let him take time-lapse. I think they were time-lapse pictures of animals of some sort. I can't remember what. Just remember him saying, "Oh, you want to see my new time lapse machine?" And it was one of those inside it.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. It's electromagnets. There's coils wrapped around a ferric core, I guess. And when you put power through the coils, it turns it into a magnet and draws the thing to the next contact. That's how these electromagnets work. I'm sure I've told the story before, but I believe it was a funeral director or something in America. It came up with the idea, and it was through necessity. Again, this is in The Secret Life of Machines. If anyone gets a chance to watch it, I would thoroughly recommend it. And he was saying that what happened was that there was a funeral director, and he noticed that business was getting quiet and he couldn't work out what was going on. And then they realized that one of the neighbors or one of the relatives was going to the funeral directors down the road and passing on information about people who had deceased. And of course, it was nicking all his business. So he said, "Oh, I'm going to fix this out." You know, oh, that's it. She worked in the telephone exchange. That was it. That was it. So she was finding out all about all these deceased people. And so he said, "I'm going to, you know, find a way of cutting out the middleman and having my own exchange. So I don't need a person to do this," and or something to that effect. And it was through necessity. He wasn't even an engineer. He just built it out of bits and pieces, you know.
That's how some of the best ideas get done, I think, isn't it? Yeah, or used to be anyway. Before it got too technical. Yeah, that's quite cool. That is very cool. Good stuff. Well, we've been chatting now for getting on for 51 minutes according to this. So do you wanna carry on, or do you wanna call it quits fairly soon?
Yeah, it's probably had enough. I was going to talk about how things are, you know.
We never got on to talking about.
No, maybe we should do that another time. I don't know, because we're getting a bit long.
Yeah, it's typical, isn't it? We say we haven't got much of an agenda. There's just a few things to chat about, and then the thing just goes on and on into all sorts of areas. But yeah, we were originally planning to just sort of cover how we've been coping with all the lockdown and everything. Well, maybe that gives us a good excuse to do this again before too long.
Yeah, yeah. What I could say is that there's I know that everyone finds these sort of things. Some people find it more difficult than others, but I'll tell you what. No, it's too complicated. Talk another time about it, because we'll get it all embroiled in all this as well. So yeah, I think that's enough, Dave. I think I.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Well, we'll call it quits at that point and say goodbye to everybody. Okay.
Yeah, so how do we say it's how do you and Craig can normally finish off? I can't remember now.
Oh yeah. So that we say something like hacker, and then the other one says
public.
And then radio. Yay. Yeah.
So that's bye everybody.
Okay.
Bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.